Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today we will return to the archives and continue reading the February 2020 issue of Guideposts with articles like My First Calling. Everyday Greatness, Maria Rose Belding. Her High-Tech Innovation is Helping Feed the Hungry, by Evan Miller, Senior Editor. Who she is? Maria Rose Belding, 24, co-launched and runs Means, an online platform connecting businesses that have surplus food with pantries and soup kitchens that need it. Means stands for Matching Excess and Need for Stability, a name Maria Rose came up with as a teenager while volunteering in her Pella, Iowa church's food pantry. She graduated from American University in May 2019 and plans to go to med school. What she does. Maria Rose had seen firsthand the difficulties that pantries have connecting with food donors. Many pantries lack landlines or listed phone numbers. If only there was a way to make the connection online, she thought. As a freshman in college, she met a student who knew computer coding. The two of them designed the Means online messaging portal in 2014. The nonprofit, run largely by volunteer high school and college students, serves more than 3,000 pantries and soup kitchens across the United States that have signed up for the free service. Why she does it? Maria Rose was inspired by a sermon her minister gave on Matthew 25:35. Those words, "For I was hungry and you gave me food," spoke directly to her. She was already volunteering at the pantry, but now it felt like something more, a way of directly serving God. One day, another church donated 10,000 boxes of mac and cheese, nearing their expiration date. The pantry director spent hours trying to reach pantries across the state looking to share, but Maria Rose ultimately tossed hundreds of boxes in the dumpster. It felt so wrong, she says. How she does it. Means works almost like a dating app. Pantries and soup kitchens check off the types of food they are looking for. When a grocery or other donor in the area posts an item that's a match, a message instantly goes out. The first organization to respond gets the donor's contact information. The system has found a home for online donations of 250 pounds of rutabagas, 1,000 pounds of green beans, 42,000 pounds of milk, even 50 pounds of squab, baby pigeon, donated by a 5-star restaurant in Seattle. Apparently, it goes great in pork and beans, Maria Rose says. On average, it takes less than 1 hour to make a match. Once a connection is made, the donor and the pantry work out the delivery details. How you can do it. If you run a food pantry or a business that has surplus food, you can sign up for Means at meansdatabase.org or contact the director of your local pantry to ask what foods they need. Some 46 million people get food assistance, and yet we throw away 30% of our food, Maria Rose says. We currently reach almost 7% of America's pantries and soup kitchens, but we want to get them all. Living longer, living better. As a judge, I never actually thrown the book at anybody, but I have written a few. My First Calling, by Deborah H. Goldstein, Birmingham, Alabama. I looked over my glasses from the bench and asked, "Is there anything else?" I was confident in the details of the case and ready to deliver a standard hearing closing. "No, Your Honor," the attorney began, but his client interrupted. "Your Honor, I've one more thing," the man said. I looked to the attorney. I'd been a judge for 23 years, a female judge from a time when that was neither expected nor particularly respected. I ran a tight ship. It was always, "Yes, Your Honor," or "No, Your Honor." I made a face that said, "Get your client under control." That should have been enough, but today the attorney threw his hands up in the air, exasperated. I knew we were in trouble. I turned to the client. "Yes, sir. What is it?" "I just want you to know, no matter how you rule, I'm buying your book." Oh, no. My insides did a somersault. I've been trying for 10 years to keep my writing separate from my career, scribbling mystery scenes in the wee hours of the morning as I put in full days behind the bench in black robes. For years, nobody had any inkling of what I did in my spare time, but that changed when my first book, Maize and Blue, was published in 2011. Followed by a number of short stories. I was trying to sell another novel, Should Have Played Poker, a Kerry Martin and the Ma Jean Player's Mystery. Magazines and local papers were now publishing articles with titles like Judge Wright's Book and Judge Wrote Mysteries. That was the marketing hook. My private passion was fast becoming common knowledge. I kept a straight face and delivered my ruling. Then I collected my things to head home. In the car, thoughts began to swirl. If everybody knew I was a writer, would that affect my role as a judge? Was the double life no longer sustainable? Would I have to make a choice I dreaded? I'd been torn between pleasing others and following my passion ever since I was a girl. My dad had wanted desperately for me to choose a practical career that would provide independence, something like nursing or teaching. It was my mother who encouraged my sister and me to do whatever we wanted. A Holocaust survivor, she was a scrapper who believed anything was possible with hard work and chutzpah, and of course, if it was God's will. I want to be a comedian, I told her once. Perfect, she said. You're as funny as Carol Burnett. When I changed my mind and decided to become a writer, she was all for it. Still, as an oldest child, I felt an obligation to please both my parents. When I graduated from the University of Michigan with degrees in English and history, along with a teaching certification, my father was thrilled. Yet it was my mother who wished me well when I moved to New York 2 days after graduation to find a job in publishing and start my writing career. Follow your dream, she cheered. I ended up working for a small publishing house. I liked what I was doing, but doubt still plagued me. What if this didn't work out? Was I disappointing my father? I started putting together law school applications at night. Law was an honorable, challenging, and secure profession, a perfectly practical match for someone with my ambition. I pushed writing to the back of my mind and focused on applications. 8 months later, I picked Emory University School of Law from among my acceptances, as much for the Atlanta weather as its prestigious reputation. Now, nose to the grindstone, I hardly noticed as time flew by. By 25, I graduated and was working as a labor lawyer in Birmingham, Alabama, arguing an equal pay case of first impression. By 30, I was married to the love of my life, Joel. We were raising 2 children from Joel's previous marriage, and later on, our own 2 kids, twins, a boy and a girl. I got active in my temple and served on numerous community boards. I published legal articles and lectures. Sure, I still wrote a little, a story or a skit here and there, but nothing serious. At age 36, I was appointed as one of the youngest federal administrative law judges in the country, one of only 26 women. I knew it was important for me to be taken seriously, especially as a woman in a male-dominated field. I didn't fraternize, didn't joke. I did sometimes wear something fun underneath my black robes, some leopard print or frilly dresses. If I was in the courthouse where I had to cross the waiting room to use the bathroom, I often left my black robes behind. I once overheard a claimant warn another, "She may look normal in a dress, but just you wait. When she's sitting above you in black robes, it's like talking to God." For years, I lived by the letter of the law, making both my parents proud. I was a judge with a heavy caseload, and my father was happy knowing I was chair of my temple's education committee. Not exactly a teacher, but close. My mother loved our blended family, my work as a Girl Scout leader, my volunteer activities, and how I centered God in my life through my temple commitments. I was proud of myself, too, but I wasn't writing much except briefs and legal articles. I couldn't help but feel as if something was missing. On top of everything, I often kept late hours with my youngest son, Stephen, who hated going to sleep. I wistfully said one evening how I missed having more time, especially time to write. 9-year-old Stephen looked up and said, "Why don't you just do it?" I was taken aback. Why not do it? Because of my job, because of my family, because of my other commitments. But how could I explain that to a child? Because, I paused, you never go to bed. When bedtime came, Stephen went right into his room and turned off the light. No muss, no fuss. With the night unexpectedly empty, I did what lots of working moms would have done. I watched a movie, painted my nails, read a magazine. In the morning, Stephen walked into the kitchen. "Well," he asked, "did you finish?" I felt like an idiot. Here I was preaching to my daughter's Girl Scout troop to reach for the sky and follow your dreams, and what was I doing? It would take almost 12 years of guilt and false starts before I finally sat down to write something significant. A friend lent me her beach condo for the weekend to give me time and space to do it. But what kind of story could I write? What did I have to say? I'd spent so much time pleasing others that I wasn't totally sure who I was. I sat at the desk and started thinking about what I knew well enough to craft into a story. University of Michigan in the 70s, I started scribbling in longhand on a legal pad. By the end of the weekend, I had 85 pages. I kept writing, filling more legal pads, and five of those original pages went on to become my first book, a whodunit called Maize and Blue. I'd become a mystery author at age 56. My mother was thrilled. My next novel, Should Have Played Poker, tumbled out. I loved writing mysteries, and for years thought I wouldn't have to choose between keeping my respectable job and following my passion. But the man in the courtroom calling me out from behind the bench now had me thinking differently. I needed to have a talk with my husband about the future of my career and our life. "Joel," I said as I walked in the door at home, "we need to run some numbers. Was it time to choose?" Joel and I had looked at our finances. We had already put our kids through school. We were in good financial shape. We could, was it possible, make things work? "This is if I wanted to." Joel went to bed and I stayed up praying. "God, do I give up my career? What is your will for me?" I'd sold a book and 13 short stories, but there was no promise of future success in writing. As I prayed, I relaxed and opened myself to divine direction. The knot in my stomach went away. I felt suddenly at peace. The next morning, I walked into the office and announced that I wanted no more cases assigned to me. "I'll work out of my docket," I promised. I reckoned it would take another 6 or 7 months to get through all the cases, but afterward, I would be free to follow my passion. The other judges looked shocked. An administrative judgeship was a lifetime appointment. "Are you sick?" one of the judges asked. Another took me aside. "What are you going to do every day?" I smiled. "Have a life." It's been more than 6 years since I left my judgeship, and I've never looked back. I've published 2 more books, One Taste Too Many and 2 Bites Too Many. The first book in Kensington's Sarah Blair's mystery series. My life as a writer isn't exactly what I expected. I'm a little disorganized, and I never write as fast as I'd like, but I love working out a mystery. Have you heard the one about how the judge leaves her day job and lets her dream and God guide her? Took me long enough to figure it out. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. A moment America came together, the polio vaccine. Think positive, 75 years, live inspired. A Test of Faith by T.W. Kirkpatrick, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Guidepost celebrates its 75th anniversary this year. We've been looking back at stories that mark important events during those years, moments when America came together. In the early 50s, polio was a national scourge. The epidemic peaked in 1952. There were nearly 58,000 cases with more than 3,000 deaths and some 21,000 people left paralyzed, most of them children. The next year, Jonas Salk announced his polio vaccine. The first volunteer to test it had been Bill Kirkpatrick, a teenage polio patient. Someone who'd already contracted polio wouldn't get the disease again if something went wrong. In 1954, his father wrote an open letter to his son in gratitude for his role in creating the life-saving vaccine. Bill not only recovered from polio, but thrived. He graduated from Franklin and Marshall College, went to seminary, and became a minister in the Episcopal Church. He served in several dioceses, scaling back his work in the 1980s when he developed post-polio syndrome. He died in 2003. Here are his father's poignant words as published in the October 1954 issue of Guideposts. "Dear son, every father has a special feeling about his son that's hard to put into words. From the day you were born, back in 1935, and all during your next 19 years of achievement, I saw a little of myself in you, just as I did in Joe, your older brother, during his school days. My hopes, my dreams, my own ambitions unfulfilled. I was proud of your boyish ability to cast for trout, your skills in other sports. I'd not forget the football game at Shadyside when you, a 130-pound tackle, kept breaking through the opposing team's line to down their 175-pound fullback back. When you were rushed to the hospital that Labor Day weekend in 1951 and put on the critical list with polio, I couldn't believe it. In the ambulance, I was too numb to say anything while your mother kept whispering, 'Keep your faith in God, son. Remember the psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.' As you fought for life, I tried to put the pieces of my own confused faith back together. How much faith did I have? Once before, I had seen it demonstrated back in 1928 when your mother was seriously ill. The doctors had given her up. I prayed then that she might live, and my prayers were answered. Had I forgotten in so short a time? Now, 23 years later, I had to admit to myself that in this crisis with polio, your mother's prayers and faith were stronger than mine. While the doctors were fighting for your life during the next few weeks, you were more concerned about another polio-stricken boy in the same ward. Remember how he kept saying, 'I wish I could die. I wish I could die.' The Reverend Mr. Penrose was the only person permitted to visit you while in isolation. And he told me how you repeated the 23rd Psalm to this boy and prayed for him, also how you led prayers with others who were suffering. And I heard that the nurses looked forward to going into your ward. They knew that, regardless of your pain, that it could always count on a smile, lighting up your face and their day. These reports made me feel more proud of you than any football or scholastic achievements. Then a series of God's miracles started to happen. Although the doctors thought you would die, you lived. They felt you would never walk again, but in 3 months, you began to sit up with the aid of a steel back brace. Remember your visit home that Christmas holiday? At midnight that New Year's Eve, Mother and I held you upright while we all sang Auld Lang Syne. She believed that if you stood on your feet at the beginning of the year, you would continue your progress. 3 months later, with some help, all 90 pounds of you stood on your feet. Dr. Jesse Wright was amazed, but stated that you would probably always have to wear leg braces. 'I'll walk without braces,' you said. Within a year, you did. Something happened to me during this period. Before you were stricken, I had always considered myself a good Christian, attending church, contributing money, serving on committees. But I honestly wonder now how much I really believed. At home, we were always too busy to have blessings at meals. When you were so helpless, I even questioned God's existence. Then you began to recover and credit it to faith and prayer. I felt ashamed. It was June 1952, while still badly paralyzed, that you and 40 other polio patients volunteered to help Dr. Jonas Salk in his experiment with a new and untried anti-polio vaccine. We had no idea until told by reporters in the spring of 1953 that you were listed as the world's case history number one to receive the vaccine. When you persuaded us to sign the consent for the test, we hesitated at first because of the possible danger. Then you talked about your brother. 'Joe has two young sons, my nephews,' you remarked. 'I'll do anything possible to help protect them and others from polio.' When you said that, I thought of Christ's words, 'Greater love hath no man than this.' John 15:13. We don't have all the results yet, Bill, but I feel sure that Dr. Salk's work may save thousands of lives. Today, I can understand clearly how God works through people and how he can use a paralyzing illness such as yours for good. I also learned about the concern and love of friends. During your illness, our telephone never seemed to stop ringing. Maddie, the Kirkpatrick's maid, gathered together a group of people in her church and held prayer meetings for your recovery. And your mother never let our spirits lag. How I remember her in those dark days, by the piano, playing and singing her favorite Welsh hymn, 'God that madest earth and heaven.' A father is fortunate when he can learn as much from his son as I have learned from you. You help me see that the test of a Christian is how he meets difficulties, tragedies, and sorrows. You also help me see this message of triumph in Christ's experience on the cross. Whether you become a doctor or a minister, I know your one concern will be to relieve suffering, to bring help and cheer to those in need. Your mother and I are very proud of you. Love, Dad. Mysterious ways, more than coincidence. My husband's death left a void in my life. Tom was only 64 when he passed. It was cancer. I was blindsided. All of my plans for the future had been made for two, not one. Most days it felt as if I were drowning in a sea of grief. My family became my lifeline. I put all of my energy into caring for them. My parents were getting along in years and needed more and more help around the house, so I ended up moving in with them. After the birth of my youngest son's twins, I found myself busy helping care for my grandbabies, too. But at every milestone, the twins' first words, their first steps, I wished that Tom could somehow be there with me. He would have been the best grandfather. Now it was 6 years later, and I still thought about Tom every day. My parents had since passed away. The twins had started preschool. I wasn't needed to babysit them as often. I had just bought my own townhouse. My life was in a good place. Still, I wish Tom could have been there with me. On what would have been our 39th wedding anniversary, December 1st, 2018, I knew I couldn't just stay in the house all alone. I needed to get out. I still had Christmas shopping to do, so I drove to a small shopping plaza nearby. I browsed in a few different stores. Then on a whim, I walked into a small jewelry boutique. I was immediately drawn to the display of rings, silver and simple. One in particular caught my eye. It wasn't my usual style, but I tried it on and it fit perfectly, as if it had been made for me. Though I still had gifts to buy and knew I could have used the money for those, something told me I needed to get this ring. I slipped off the ring and brought it up to the cashier. "It's beautiful," she said as she rang up the purchase. "These rings are handmade, you know. The artist puts a lot of love into each piece. She even engraves a special message on the inside of each one." "Oh, let's see what mine says," I said. I turned the ring over in my hands, then froze. Engraved inside the ring were the words, "I am always with you." Tom was still with me after all. Debbie Malta, Webster, New York. Have your own mysterious ways story? Send it to mw@guideposts.org. Guidepost Books, Extraordinary Women. They were strong, they were tough, they were faithful, and they were mostly unheralded until now. By Rick Hamlin, Executive Editor. I was listening to my favorite Bible podcast when one of the guests, a guy mind you, pointed out, "You know, it's the women in the Gospels who get it about Jesus. They're often the first to really understand who he is." "Wow," I thought, "that's something I'd never noticed before." I looked down, took down my Bible, and turned to Luke's Gospel. Mary is there in the first chapter, of course, startled to learn from the angel Gabriel how she's been called by God. Then she goes to visit her relative Elizabeth, pregnant with John the Baptist, to share the good news. These two women are major figures in this age-old story, but as I kept turning the pages, it was the lesser-known women whose stories jumped out at me. Like Anna, the prophet, who had been waiting her whole life for the appearance of this Savior. An 84-year-old woman, she never left the temple in Jerusalem, worshiping and praying day and night. When the infant Jesus is brought there to be blessed, Anna praises God, knowing that this is the one who will bring redemption to the world. It's a cameo appearance. She appears, she sees Jesus, understands who he is, and then is gone. Other women come onto the scene, and unlike the 12 disciples, don't even get named, yet their holiness is called out. For instance, as Jesus watches the rich people making a big show of putting gifts into the collection box at the temple, calling attention to their wealth, he points to a poor widow who throws in two small copper coins, a mere mite. The rich are just giving their spare change. She has given everything she has. Or consider the woman who had bled for 12 long years. She'd spent all her money on doctors to no avail. Desperate for healing, she merely touches the hem of Jesus' robe in the midst of a crowd. Her bleeding stops. He feels the power leave him and calls her out. "Daughter, your faith has healed you," he says. "Go in peace." There is the woman with the alabaster vase full of perfumed oil. Uninvited, she enters the Pharisee's house where Jesus is eating and kneels at his feet. Characterized as someone of dubious reputation, she weeps, wetting Jesus' feet with her tears, wiping them with her hair, pouring the oil on them. The Pharisee is appalled, not Jesus. "You didn't anoint my head with oil," he says to the man, "but she has poured perfumed oil on my feet." He lets her know her sins are forgiven. "Your faith has saved you." In some traditions, the woman is thought to be Mary Magdalene, who makes an appearance named in the next chapter. The point in all these instances is that the people who come to Jesus in humility, in need, and in the most abject circumstances know who he is, and their lives are changed. I thought back to an Easter sermon our pastor once gave. She noted that at the crucifixion, it was the women who followed Jesus from Galilee, who stuck around till the bitter end, mourning their loss, and they were the ones going to the tomb with spices, who were the first to bear witness to the resurrection. It was as though being present during such grave sorrow allowed them the vision that was beyond their greatest hopes, a reminder that sadness can open us up to unexpected revelations. Every character in the Bible feels extraordinary in extraordinary times and extraordinary situations. But those who got called out are often not the ones who called themselves out. They are everyday people, people like us, ready to love, ready to be changed. Editor's note: Guidepost has launched a new fiction series, Ordinary Women of the Bible, imagining the lives of people who make the briefest of appearances in scriptures and yet have much to tell us about how to live in faith and expectation. For more information, see the insert after page 18. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.